Ari Rosenbaum here with another fun-filled episode of that 401k podcast. This week's topic, how 401k plan providers need to be secure after secure, 1.0 and 2.0. But of course, first things first, that 401ksite.com for further information on all our live events. Arlington's coming up, less than 2 months away, May the 3rd. Globe Life Field, I believe that it's called. Special guest Dave Valley, who is a Ranger, former Ranger and current Ranger broadcaster, and I understand he'll probably be doing some Yankee games on YES this season as a fill-in. Then June the 7th, Yankee Stadium, the Bronx, New York, guest to be announced hopefully soon. So let's get to the topic at hand, 401k plan providers needing to be secure after secure. So when I started out as an ERISA attorney, listen, I took a couple of courses at Boston University School of Law for my tax LLM degree, one on, you know, ERISA and one on non-qualified plans. I had certainly an interest in it. But, you know, when you start out, you know, as an ERISA attorney back in 98, I'll say it, I was making $35,000 a year. I mean, I laugh about it now. I mean, the funny thing about making $35,000 a year in 1998, I felt more, I was living at home and, you know, not having kids and all that. I felt a lot wealthier than I do now, and I make a lot more than $35K. But, you know, with the expenses and all that stuff, I just laugh about it. So I worked at, you know, this law firm that was affiliated with Mobius Tech, which eventually got bought out and became CBIZ Retirement Services, Inc., and whatever. We lost that business when CBIZ sold all that stuff to Bisys. But best teacher I have ever had in the retirement plan business in terms of, you know, nuts and bolts and all that kind of stuff, was a paralegal by the name of Marsh Tracy. You know, she was a very tough lady, very gruff. When you're 26 years old and being immature, you can't deal with somebody at that time and understand what they were trying to do. Again, when you're 26 as opposed to when you're 36, You don't understand, and she had a really gruff, and it just didn't mesh well with me. I was, you know, I was naive and immature and trying to get along with people and all that kind of stuff. But I really learned a lot from her. I've, you know, thanked her in the past, you know, wrote an article about her a while back when I think I started my practice, and, you know, I know she was still around then. But one thing I've always learned from Marge was, Marge was interesting. She was a paralegal. I don't even know if she had any paralegal training, because I think in those days there wasn't such a thing. I mean, she predated, in the retirement plan business, she predated ERISA. So she was working in the business from the 70s, early 70s. And one of the things that she told me that I will always keep with me is she said, you know, a lot of third-party administration firms, they went out of business after the Tax Reform Act of 86. They couldn't deal with it. And if you know the history of the Tax Reform Act of 86, big changes in the law, big changes in how plans were administered and all that. I think defined benefit plans basically went into mothballs for about 3 years in terms of accruing and all that stuff. So the point of it was, there, anytime there's a change in retirement plan business, people will go out of business. People will leave the business. That's the nature of the business. They say, you know, listen, I can't get along with the change. I'm going to go out of business. Some of the biggest corporate disasters we've seen were as a result of companies not coming to grip with changes in the technology. I mean, Blockbuster Video to me is always going to be the example of a business that, you know, they weren't done in by streaming. They were done in a while before that by, you know, the little DVD envelopes by Netflix. When Netflix was known as that DVD rental place by mail. you know, and we saw a few disclosure regulations. Everybody, a lot of Chicken Littles thought that was the end of the business. Only the cheapest plan providers are going to make out. And, you know, we know the reality of it was that that didn't happen. The cheapest providers didn't get all the business. There was a lot of fee compression, but a lot of, you know, insurance companies and TPAs, they went out of business, they sold their business, they sold their block of plans and said, hey, listen, I can't deal with a environment like this, I'm out of here. So this, you know, really the thing is that you have to be secure after secure. A lot of changes in the law, understand where the changes are, and understand that some things are not as big as you think they are. And, you know, what do they say? A nothing burger was the expression. And speaking of nothing burgers, I'll get in trouble for this, but Peps. They say that, you know, the joke was, you know, certain things are the best things since sliced bread, and I just don't really, it's like a George Carlin line, I don't understand. Here's a bread, here's a knife, what's the big deal? And, you know, for some time, people thought that Peps were going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread, and I think Peps are a little bit overrated, just like sliced bread. You know, they were codified into the law through the First Secure Act because the Department of Labor for about a good 9 years didn't want to do anything with multiple employer plans. They wanted to, you know, they still had that belief that MEPs needed commonality among adopting employers to be a single plan for ERISA purposes. So they were a big deal. You know, I think they you know, the concept of it is still a big deal. The problem, you know, it filled a need and a niche. And again, I think it's not the greatest thing since sliced bread because I think that many plan providers finally realize that, wow, it takes a lot to grow a PEP. It takes a long time. It's not a fun process. The most successful PEP I've ever had is a MEP that's converting over to a PEP, and that, you know, it took 7-8 years to build it to $175 million in assets. That's just the nature of the business. You know, it's there are a lot of issues. You know, I think the I call it the anti-PEP bent, where you know, we thought that the audits weren't needed until you hit 1,000 or, you know, had an adopting employer with more than 100, and then the DOL said no, you need a audit with 100 or more participants with account balance. So that was certainly a killer, and it's going to be cost prohibitive for a lot of us in the PEP business. That's not something that we expected. You know, unfortunately, I think that that will put a lot of PEPs out the pasture. I'm working on, a PEP that we're going to, you know, organize and kind of be the end-all solution for a lot of the folks that have these PEPs that were small in business and small in asset size, and they need a stable home. But, you know, until a plan really achieves a critical mass in terms of plan assets, it's not going to be as popular, you know, and be the cost savings that everybody thought it would be. To me, PEPs, the best marketing tool of it was the, you know, delegating the fiduciary function. Until you get assets of a big size, you know, you're not really going to get the cost savings that you really thought. And that that really, you know, that really happens. I mean, you know, the running joke I had is that if I ever got a nickel from an advisor who had a PEP idea, I'd be really rich. You know, it's an effective solution. It's a great tool. I think the best tool is for those states that are going to have that auto IRA force, where, you know, if they don't offer a retirement plan, they got to sign up for the auto IRA or offer a plan on their own. I think that's a great selling point to join a PEP for that. But until that time, I mean, it's not easy. So the next is this whole after-tax employer contribution. A lot of times over the years, the IRS and, you know, DOL come up with these ideas. They think they're really a big deal, and then they're not. And I mean, it's also with the code, Congress gets into it. And I remember one of the big deals that I've never run across it is the sidecar IRA. Now, this was an option. I think it's still on the books. I've never run into a plan that offered it. An employee could make their IRA contributions into the 401k plan if the 401k plan allowed it. That was as popular as dog do. It wasn't popular, never caught on. TPA wasn't going to, you know, I think people are better off going to their own IRA provider. TPAs weren't going to file at 5498 or whatever that valuation of the IRA account. It just never made any sense. I mean, there are obviously Roth options, you know, the kind of the sidecar Roth or whatever it is for the folks that can no longer afford a Roth contribution. Those are options. So, you know, it's, again, not popular. I think this after-tax Roth employer contribution is going to be have zero popularity. The problem with this whole after-tax employer contribution, if a plan allows, a participant can direct that they want to pay their taxes up front on their employer contributions. I don't like the idea. I think it's terrible. And the reason I think it's a terrible idea is the whole tax reporting aspect of it. Now, when the law finally hit the books, I thought, oh, okay, somehow we'll adjust it with their payroll. They'll pay the taxes up front. This will be a payroll provider function. And somehow, I don't know, was it the IRS or whatever, came out with their guidance. And it really destroyed the whole reasoning behind it. I mean, I don't like it in the sense that one of the big problems with it is, number one, because it's after tax, employee will be paying tax on their contributions. It's got to be fully vested. So plan sponsors got a six-year schedule. You know, I work for a company. If they had a choice, they'd still use the old 20-year schedule. Nobody wants to fully vest for those who could pay the taxes up front, of course, unless it's the owner of the company. More importantly, on the tax reporting aspect of it, again, I thought they would run it through payroll. Employee would pay the taxes through their payroll check. No, it doesn't work like that. They're going to get issued a 1099-R to pay the taxes as if they would on a deferral refund. And that's not fun. I do some taxes on the side for some existing clientele. I never really tried to grow that business for the longest time, for like the last 13 years, because it's a lot of work for little money. And, you know, I see with the SALT limitation on the 1040s, the big impact. You know, I just did a taxes of a friend who had, you know, between state income tax and property tax, you're looking at a $23,000 deduction, what would have been in the old days, and now they're capped out at 10. So an employee who, you know, wants this option, they got to get a 1099, so they don't pay the taxes up front. And if they have a SALT deduction limitation, they may have a big tax bill come April 15th, which reminds me, I got to start doing my taxes this week. You know, I really should rush it a little bit more, but, you know, when you have all these corporate corporate tax forms to do, you kind of don't want to do that. So then you don't do that. And of course, one of the issues, again, with this after-tax employer contribution is who's going to issue the, 1099-R or whatever. One thing in the retirement plan business, it's a running joke that I have. I don't like to volunteer people for anything. Mainly because in my household, I'm always volunteered to do things. I wouldn't volunteer the TPA to do things, but of course it would make sense that the TPA would be the one issuing the 1099-R. And of course, TPAs would want to make money off of that. You know, they shouldn't do more work and not get compensated for it. I love the idea of Roth IRAs and Roth 401k deferrals. Don't get me, you know, I have a Roth IRA. And if my 401k could allow for after-tax Roth, I'd do that too. But I just think it's just really a difficult thing, too much of a hard work for little interest, because I really believe that outside the owners of a company, I don't see it being particularly popular. It's just a lot of work for just a whole lot of nonsense. Next is the emergency savings account. Again, I think this is another provision that just really wasn't necessary. Pension-linked emergency savings accounts. They're this option of after-tax money. Again, it's kind of like that sidecar IRA I talked about. Participant put away $2,500. May be able to withdraw from the account at the discretion without paying a 10% early withdrawal fee. Now, a lot of large companies may be offering it. I don't think a lot of small companies will. Again, it's a lot of work for a little amount of money. Again, I'm sitting here where 5 feet of water was here during Hurricane Sandy. I don't think $2,500 is something that really helps plan participants out that much. It's putting in money, their after-tax money, kind of like those old voluntary contributions. I just think it's a lot of work, a lot of record keeping that really isn't necessary. I just think that the plan participant should, you know, put that $2,500 somewhere else, make some money on it, and then withdraw it in case they have that emergency. Again, I think it's not attractive because, again, it's after tax, it's only $2,500, and I just don't think it's really something that I would consider. Next is the de minimis incentive rule. This is always interesting. The contingent benefit rule said you could condition benefits on people making deferrals or not making deferrals. Now, the de minimis incentive rule is a workaround that. It gives people the opportunity to, you know, get people to defer. The regulations basically say it's for people who didn't defer to get them to defer. You can't exceed $250. Again, it's to employees who don't have an existing election to defer. I think this is one of these rules that, I think some ingenious plan provider is going to come up with the idea to offer this and go overboard, and it's a problem. You know, I always thought that one way to draw interest to these enrollment meetings is for raffle off, or the attendees raffle off a gift card to Amazon or something like that to get them get their butts in seats, as Jim Ross would say. And again, a plan provider is going to come up with the idea, well, let's give everybody $25 for them to defer. And the problem with that is that costs money, costs a lot of money. And who's going to pay for that? And a plan sponsor is not going to want to pay for that. And I don't know if that's a really good expense to do a per head charge to give everybody a $25 gift card. And of course, my running joke is I think someone is going to try a 401k gift card company or it's just going to flop. I just don't think it's going to be very, very popular because, again, it's an expense. And when it comes to paying bills, a lot of people, they disappear. It's kind of like in Curb Your Enthusiasm when there was that couple, they were always going out to dinner and the guy somehow always, lost his wallet or something like that. Next is the student loan match. It was a revenue ruling, I believe, that it was, that allowed it. And, there could be matching contributions with respect to qualified student loan payments, which covers loans for tuition, fees, room, board expenses incurred by students who are enrolled at least half-time in the degree program in an accredited post-secondary school. I know a thing or two about student loans. Student loans were finally paid off after a 25-year period a few months back. Couple that with my mortgage, I'm kind of debt free except for the credit cards, account balances, pay it full every month. But the problem with the student loan matches, it gets treated like a match. You test it separately from the rest of the plan participant pool for those who get ordinary match contributions because they do defer. They're kind of considered safe harbor match contributions for both regular safe harbor plans and qualified automatic contribution arrangements. You know, I don't know if small to medium-sized businesses want to offer it because you're giving away matching contributions to people who don't defer and they can't defer because they're, you know, making a student loan payment. This can be a good tool to recruit employees. Again, it's the nature of the business. You have an electrical contracting firm, people didn't go to college. You know, a lot of people, I don't think that that's going to be as popular, you know, as, let's say, a law firm. Law firm, geez, unless you're independently wealthy, you have kind of some student loan debt to consider and to finance. So I think that, out of some of these provisions, that probably is going to be the most popular. And we'll see what happens. But again, you know, plan sponsors are, I wouldn't say cheap, but, you know, this is how it is and whatnot. So that's how it is and whatnot. So, we'll see, you know, over time how popular some of these provisions are. I think most of them are not going to be popular, especially on the small to medium size plan, area of the business. So that's my two cents. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the F1K Podcast. Go to that 401ksite.com. Sign up for our live events. $100 to attend. Yankees, Rangers. It'll be a lot of fun. You know, Yankee Stadium, we've got quite a few people signed up already. Same thing with Texas. Really happy with the interest, both on the sponsorship level and the participant level. That's great stuff. And of course, like I said, go to that 401ksite.com, sign up. If you have an advisory firm and multiple people from your firm want to attend, always email me, see what we can do in terms of, you know, going off of that $100. I've always done that just as a courtesy, you know, always trying to draw attendance. You get 5 or 6 people from the advisory firm, you know, you could do a lot better than $100 a head. So reach out to me. And of course, tune in next week for another fun-filled episode of the F1K Podcast.